You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to The Bottom Line, where I will discuss the exciting world of football finance with Chief Business of Football writer at Reach, Dave Powell. We've been doing this on and off for a while, Dave, but now me and you are official. We are done it. And also, I couldn't think of a name for it, so we've just stolen yours, if that's okay.
It's a good one. It's a good one. I'm pleased when I came up with it. I'm even more pleased now it's been taken onto a whole new plane.
Well, we're going to be video, we're going to be audio. This will be available as a podcast and also on our YouTube channel as well. And we're going to try and do it once a month and more regularly because, Dave, the people have spoken. So we do a subscriber survey where we ask people who listen to and watch our stuff, you know, all manner of things really with regard to what we should do more of. But one of the questions was, what kind of shows would you like more of? And then number one was tactics and stats shows, which is maybe the side of the times and where football analysis has gone. And number two was immediate news reaction. But in number three, ahead of things like fan culture and interviews and even transfer shows, was football finance. So that is what people want more of. So who knew you were in such demand?
On the podium. On the podium, that's what I'm saying. On the podium, gunning for the number one spot.
I mean, ahead of transfers.
Next hour, well, not surprisingly. The worst part of football fandom is transfers.
Maybe people have just decided that we've done enough. We can't possibly do any more. It was interesting just how low FSG ownership updates was.
In this. We're not doing that one next.
We can do because it's all sort of relevant here, but I think sometimes the people who are obsessed about it, yeah, think everyone else is in case, but whenever we ask about these sorts of things, people aren't that bothered at all. So there we are, but they are bothered about football finances. So me and Dave are going to be doing this, I think, about once a month. We'll try and check in as it went. Dave's, you know, very busy schedule sort of allows, really. But we're going to be talking about Liverpool finances, but also wider football, and there's both of those in today's show. So part two, we're going to be talking about the Business Football Summit, which took place in London last week that the Financial Times organised, that me and Dave both went down to. And I thought there was some really interesting stuff, and I know Dave did as well, because we got some food after. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, about things that jumped out and that I think will be of particular interest to football fans, because, you know, that's what we are, and it's interesting to hear how the other half, if you like, talk about us on occasion. So a few things that jumped out for me from there that I'm going to discuss with Dave. But first of all, I think while we were on the way down there, actually, Dave, the latest LFC counts were announced, and you need to be a little bit careful with these sorts of things because it's a snapshot of time, isn't it? And so by the time they're all ratified and, you know, beans have been counted and abacuses have been slided across and stuff like that, by the time they do actually comes out, it's sort of months later and the club has moved on, football's moved on. But it is an interesting way of judging how Liverpool are doing, how Liverpool are growing or otherwise. And also when you look, and we'll do a little bit of this as well in comparison to other football clubs of a similar size, let's say. But these are the accounts for more or less the 22-23 season. So it's not perfect because, you know, financial years are 12 months and football seasons tend to be not quite. But this is effectively 1st of June till the end of May 22-23 season, where Liverpool didn't have a fantastic season. They were in the Champions League, so you get your sort of money from that. But certainly not a successful season as the season before, and so that's reflected in the accounts, as you could imagine. A few things have gone down, but a few other things actually off the pitch and commercial revenue and stuff like that has gone up, and so it sort of ends up evening itself out.
Yeah.
From a revenue point of view.
Yeah, so I mean, 9 million loss, but revenues were largely static. I think it was a 5.94, I think, for the year. So it kind of, year to year, it remains static, but there's so many moving parts in terms of related to competitive success, which have a knock-on effect. So the 9 million, I mean, first and foremost, I mean, we've spoken about this in previous podcasts. I mean, football's a loss-making business. I mean, there's very few people that make money from it. So it's largely about staying within the realms of or the confines of the financial controls and not hemorrhaging money to the point where it becomes dangerous to the future of the business. So 9 million loss, neither here nor there. It comes off the back of the previous year was a small profit. So, I mean, in terms of profit and sustainability calculations, I mean, it doesn't really factor into Liverpool's thinking because they're so far above having to think about £105 million loss over 3 years. You know, they're nowhere near those kind of figures. But it is instructive in terms of it shows the impact of a poor season. First and foremost, we're looking at this from its comparison is a year when Liverpool finished second, 15 minutes away from winning the Premier League.
And played every single game they could
every
have,
single
which is
game
important from a match day revenue.
Possibly could. Yeah. So from match day revenue and also broadcast. So yeah. Champions League run to the final. So they got all the broadcast money they could possibly get from the Champions League. And that's where the significant reduction has been. I think it's 17 million from media revenues, which is attributed to the fact that they didn't play additional games.
Yeah.
And then the match day revenue is impacted through lack of games again. So so it's important to look in that context. It's a fairly solid set of results given the nature of football, and it just means that the ship is bobbed along during a season of relative struggle. I mean, we're going to see next year the impact of no Champions League football, which will mean that results are likely to look fairly sketchy again comparing to what it was when they were making lots and lots of money when they won the Champions League. So it's important to note that this will probably be a trend which looks the same again in 12 months maybe, but as you said at the top, this is a snapshot in time. 9-10 months ago, actually what the club, I mean, it's going to take something drastic for the club not to qualify for the Champions League this year. And that means they're returning to it next year. So the outlook in the future is for the next couple of years is fairly rosy. But it's just this year reflects this counting period we're looking at reflects a period where they, you know, it just shows the impact of early exits from even domestic competitions. Because while the Carabao Cup is, amazing that, you know, the club won it this year. But last year was a fourth round exit, and just the fact of having less games is impactful if you've got a stadium, especially moving forward with the stadium capacity at 61,000-62,000.
Yeah.
Lost revenue, I mean, that match day revenue is going to be pushing 4 million a game, so 3.5-4 million a game. So all these things are important. So I think it, on the face of it, yeah, that there is a loss, but it's important to look at the strands of where these things are going. So commercial revenue spiked considerably. It's £25 million increase. That's fairly significant. Obviously, the Standard Chartered deal is included in that. That's a multi-year deal extended through last summer. Expedia deal as well. And there's also the fact the Nike deal keeps on generating returns through the expanded partnership they did with LeBron, etc. New merchandise, reaching new demographics, and the fact they have that 20% royalty kickback from the sale of official Nike merchandise helps in that respect. This doesn't include activations like Google Pixel, UPS, Peloton. So there's plenty, like I said before, there's lots that is going to drive revenue forward. But it's just this particular period we're looking at here. It seems like things are a bit flat, especially when you put it into comparison with what Manchester City have done off the back of a treble winning season and, you know, more commercial partnerships and soft mech, you know. It's, but I think if you look at the overarching trend of all the Premier League clubs, this is a fairly stable set of results on the back of what was a difficult season.
I want to talk a little bit more about that commercial growth, because, you know, it is impressive, and you know, like you said as well, that the fact is that actually that summer, so the summer that's not included in this, they signed up a few really big sort of big hitters, a large blue tick companies, and Google Pixel in particular have been very active. And we were recording this after the weekend where Virgil grabbed the phone and stuff like that. And you're seeing all this kind of fan footage, and it is interesting for supporters that the journey that we've been on with this sort of thing. And listen, not everyone's on the same journey or on the journey at the same time, but just, you know, if you allow me to speak a little bit generally about how Liverpool fans in particular have reacted to commercial deals. And I think if you go back to the 90s, it was seen as very much a bit of a crass thing. What's up, Man United? Man United, they've got official partners for this and that, and we're not sort of really like that. And then obviously they sailed off into the sunset in terms of success. And so I think there was for a while, a begrudging acceptance that Liverpool needed to do more of that sort of thing to catch up financially. And so it went from, and I'm talking from a fan point of view here, a bit of sort of hostility towards, you know, all these partnerships and all these brands being involved, to a reluctant acceptance, to now something maybe a little bit more positive than that. And I don't think we're quite at the stage where a big deal with Coca-Cola is celebrated like a new signing. But you don't necessarily want that, because, you know, we are football purists at heart. But at the same time, I think people are pleased when they see these companies come on board. And actually, some of the content that has been created is good, is of a high standard. You know, you talk about Google Pixel there. I really like the thing. Obviously, the Virgil does grabs the phone at the weekend. That's a little bit spontaneous. I'm sure that wasn't planned. How could it have been, you know, in terms of that moment? But the stuff that was planned with my friend Errol, who was down at the Albert Dock and doing those sort of moments, and it, you know, with the players and things like that. And it does involve, you know, of a lot of supporters, and supporters are at the heart of it and kind of things like that. And it does feel like now that there is not necessarily a, you know, like I said, a case that we're going to start celebrating these deals and you know, like the our new signings or even Liverpool victories. But at the same time, it is interesting to me how there is not just an acceptance now, but actually a bit of a warm embrace with regard to, well, what these deals can actually mean for the club.
No one's going to be knee sliding after the announcement of an official pillow partner or something like that, official mattress provider.
Yeah.
But just to reference your point then about Google Pixel, while the Virgil moment, I think, was, you know, it's completely spontaneous, because you can't plan for a 99th minute winner, you know, in front of a packed away end and while you're chasing the title down. But someone's there with a Google Pixel camera,
yeah,
and they're waiting for some kind of moment, just in the fact they might get something. I mean, because last minute winners happen, you know, they're
Liverpool good at them, Dave.
They're very good at them. So that type of thing. So I think they put themselves in a position for a spontaneous outcome. But yeah, I mean, but football evolves, whether we like it or not. I'm a traditionalist. I'm purist.
You're a fan of a fan owned.
Yeah. I'm not going to mention the club again, because I do it all the time. It's like this ends up me becoming like a massive plug for just Chester Football Club. But no, it's I love old grounds. I love the smell of old grounds. I love the feel, the atmosphere, all that type of stuff. That's from schlepping up and down the country watching lower league football. But I miss large Premier League grounds. But like everything, time moves on. Sands of time moves on, and younger generations come on board and more interested in how they are engaged with by clubs, etc. So these are businesses now. I mean, while it's horrible to think of them like that, I mean, obviously the beating heart and soul and the reason why people come and people engage in the first place is always the football. It will always be the football. Once that element starts to become secondary, then the whole thing doesn't work. With everything that has come, a rise of wages, transfer fees, the cost of putting the lights on, the cost of, don't we know about that, but no. The, you know, stadium development, infrastructure, creating new academies, investing in the women's game, community, all this thing costs money that has to be found from somewhere, and match day revenue no longer matches up with the cost of running a football club. So,
and we don't want it to either, Dave, crucially.
No,
like,
that's just
it. Like, we want to pay a semi-reasonable amount for a football ticket.
Of course. And then you've got, prize money factors into that, but not everyone can win, and you can't predicate
a
business model on winning all the time, because it just won't happen. Doesn't matter who you are. Manchester City might, feel like they're cleaning up all the time now, but there will be a period in time where they just don't. That's just the nature of the beast. So you have to have a thread of revenue which drives along and you can rely on, outside of the variables of, we might not qualify for the Champions League, we might win the Champions League. There has to be revenue stream, which is a constant among all that, so you can budget effectively, you can pay wages, you can engage and try and be better. We trumpet these things because, the clubs do, because it's certainly for Liverpool. I do think you can read into the stature and the position of a club in a moment in time through who they engage with and the types of deals they do. So Liverpool do a lot of renewals. So they don't do too many new deals coming on board in terms of visible partnerships. They've done a few recent years, but that's because of offering new partnerships. So
yeah.
Wasabi, the official hot cloud storage provider or whatever, they didn't have those in 1973 or whatever. But Carlsberg's still on the scene. Standard Chartered now is, by the end of the deal, I think it's going to be 18, 19 years, maybe longer than that.
It's Carlsberg 30 years, isn't
Carlsberg
it?
Carlsberg's 30
unbelievable.
Years. Then you've got a Speedy, which renewed last year. And so they're good at renewals. They partner with a lot of blue chip companies. So there's not a lot of firms there that you can't find a direct link to. So I know who UPS are. I know who Peloton are. I know who Coca-Cola is. I don't know who some firms are that have a stock Shutterstock image of a CEO, which kind of
offices that don't exist.
Yeah, in the Cayman Islands or the Isle of Man or somewhere. So
this is all the clubs we're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not naming any names here. So you can tell a lot by that. So these are, and I know from having dealt closely with people that work on these deals, both here and in the US, that so much time and energy is put into this, but the main selling point remains Liverpool as a brand, because it has a story which is unparalleled, really. So all this is valuable, and it's all linked to the football again. So football always remains front and centre, but now in the economy we live in, it's the football. It's a football. We talked about the business of football last week. We went to that summit. It is a business, and it sounds awful to say it, but you have to pay your way, and you have to do it in a way which is sustainable. Because I know we've talked about this previously, about some clubs have not really pursued that strategy and have ended up deep in debt and struggling, etc. But the idea is you have to grow revenues along with success, and you have to the wage bill has to support that and everything. So yeah, I think it's just a case of, this is the thread which you can pull through the whole thing and rely on, whereas you can't always rely on media revenues, matchday revenues, or indeed prize money. So this is the one thing which clubs can actually bank on and have an impact on themselves, and kind of have some security over it.
And then ultimately give to footballers, which is what football clubs do. And that was something that that was talked about a lot in the Footballer Finance event. Was I think the analogy used was prune juice at one point, but it's the idea of these football clubs, make money and spend more money and ultimately give it to footballers. And the wages have increased. And there was a little bit of surprise by that when I noticed people saw it. Liverpool's wages are now £373 million. So as a percentage of turnover is in what is deemed a sort of a healthy amount. But it's the second highest in the league, Dave, behind Man City. It's worth saying it was only £208 million in 2018. So if you think about that as an increase, it's almost doubled in 5 years. Where now Liverpool have been very successful. And, I want to talk a little bit more about that. But it is interesting to compare it with other clubs. So as I say, wages are £373. Chelsea's in the same period was £360. So you would argue that Liverpool gets a better value, certainly, than Chelsea. But Arsenal's a massive jump down to £235 million. Now, I would imagine these young players who are playing really well for Arsenal will want nice big contracts soon. But, it does show that the fact that Liverpool have, managed to get ahead in that period. But in terms of that year, in terms of this year as a sort of a snapshot, I think there was maybe a little bit of surprise that, because it's always been spoken about that Liverpool's wages are linked to success and there's a lot of bonus related sort of contracts. Is this an indication to you that maybe Liverpool went away from that? Because I mentioned there with Arsenal the fact that, you know, you can keep young, you can sign young players on decent contracts from a club point of view and from a player point of view when they sign it. But at some point, you know, the likes of Saka and Odegaard are going to want paying. Have Liverpool found themselves in a similar sort of situation there? It does have to be borne in mind that actually, and again, it's talking about the snapshot. So the summer that isn't counted here, they lost Fabinho, they lost Henderson, they lost Chamberlain, they lost Milner, they lost Firmino, probably others who were on really, really sort of big money. And so actually, the year after this, I do expect it to go down. But saying all that, though, I was a little bit surprised to see wages go up, considering Liverpool, you know, ultimately didn't have a particularly successful season.
The Arsenal comparison, they're good now. They were good last season. For 7-8 years, maybe before that, they were kind of flirting with 7th and 8th, and nobody's getting bonuses for finishing 8th. So with that means that during that period, Liverpool have probably activated about 3 bonuses, maybe 4 during that period, maybe between 2017 and now, which is where you get the significant upturn in wages from the 208 figure, I think it was. That's where a lot of the bonuses come in. So you are rewarding success. Now, in terms of this season, obviously we've got the Mo Salah contract. Now, that is, you know, he's become Liverpool's record most highest paid player of all time. There's various reports of what he earns, and wouldn't like to put a figure on it, but it's probably, we're looking at double what he was on,
yeah,
potentially, maybe a little bit less. That's a lot each year, but then there's also potential for signing on fees, agents fees, all that goes into it. So while, you know, there was also contract renewals during that period, they signed Darwin and Cody Gakpo, two fairly weighty deals that they did.
It was a big squad, wasn't it?
Yeah,
in that season.
And they didn't shed too much. Mane went, but Mane was never, even though he was so important to Liverpool, he was never an earner on the same level as some of his counterparts. So, I think it's a bit of a strange one this year, because you've got obviously the Salah contract and then a few other things, bits and bobs around the size, two new big additions, potential signing on fees again for the Salah contract. And then you've not really alighted so many from the wage bill. Whereas I think next year, as you said, I think you'll probably see some heavy hitters go, and I think the players they've brought in are probably on slightly less money, younger profile, and I think that will start to address that change. But yeah, it has been heavily bonus driven as well, so that's the reason why it's got to 366, because it jumped like 50-odd million, I think, last financial year, because of the success in the Champions League, reaching, you know, finishing high in the Premier League, won 2 cups, and because they came so close, you know, I think there were a lot of bonuses activated there, a lot of contract renewals as well. So there were reasons for that, but I don't envisage it going significantly up again in the next financial year. It might creep up a little bit, but I think in the main, the likelihood is it'll probably decrease, which is why I think they may well be hanging on to see in terms of some of their renewals that are doing with players to factor into the next financial year potentially, as opposed to this one.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
It does you know, when you read this and when you see the numbers and the numbers being talked now for wages is so high that it does sharpen the mind a little bit. Well, it sharpens my mind, maybe not others, who probably should on transfer fees. And often it's been a criticism leveled at FSG that they don't spend enough on transfers. But when then you look at this and you think, well, if Arsenal in this financial year spent £235 million on wages and Liverpool spent £373 million, that's a £140 million difference. I mean, that's where the money's going. Mm. So when football clubs and sporting directors and owners and, you know, however you want to characterise Mike Gordon in all that, when they're looking at what they spend on footballers, they're looking at player amortization, is it called? But it's the whole thing altogether, isn't it? And so and this isn't me sort of, you know, trying to necessarily go to bat for FSG or anything like that, because I'd always like them to spend more. But I think we do need to start, I think, thinking and discussing, you know, football spend in a slightly different way, because the days of wages being quite low and spending £10 million on a footballer are sort of gone, really. And, you know, I think we're going to see more free transfers over the next few years. You look at someone like Mbappe moving, you know, potentially to Real Madrid and how that's all sort of characterised. You know, generally, if your wage bill's pretty low, you can throw some money around, whereas if it's as high as Liverpool's, it becomes a lot harder. And so, you know, if you're looking at where Arsenal got the money for Declan Rice, well, it's there. It's £140 million difference in wages. Does that make sense, what I've just said?
Yeah, I mean, amortization is how...
That's it. Amortization is something else, Dave.
It's just how transfer... I mean, they could be paid in one instalment, they could be paid in two, three, four instalments, but in terms of how they're accounted for, it's just the guaranteed transfer fee, not including add-ons, divided over the length of the contract. Now, that's maxed out at 5 years now. Chelsea, that's because UEFA and Premier League acted after Chelsea were offering 7, 8, 9 years to reduce the cost of those players. But we're going down another route there. But everyone wants value for money in the transfer market, even Chelsea, or whoever wants value for money if they can. So the Chelsea idea was spend now and be kings for the next decade and get the revenue and spoils that come with that and the prize money. Whether that works, I don't know. It doesn't look like it at the moment. But everything, and so we're on this massive ride of transfer fees massively inflating and increasing because of media revenues are underpinning the spend. Now, media revenues, we've got last cycle's Premier League deal was 5 billion. The next cycle is going to be 6.7. But in getting that 6.7 figure, they've gone from 3 years to 4 years and they've given away 70 extra games a year. So that's 70 extra games, so it's more inventory given away. So in the wider sense, that's less money for each and every single Premier League game, less value put on it. Clubs will get more money, yes, but in terms of the value of each game has been devalued, if that makes sense. International rights will be the next one. That'll grow again, and it might have one more cycle of growth, then that will start. Like the Premier League rights to plateau and decline. Nothing goes up forever. It's anti-Darwinian to think that things just go up and up and up. The rise in spend and transfer fees and wages was linked so closely to media revenues rising in comparison to the rest of Europe. Now, if the Premier League gets too far away from Europe, rest of Europe, they have a problem because who are they selling these players to? They can't just sell into the Premier League the same players every single season because the wage difference becomes so big and so vast between Serie A and the Premier League. And there's only really Real Madrid who participate in that because it's a completely different business model there. I mean, they are effectively Spain's golden goose. So Saudi came in last summer, changed the... gave some clubs an out where they couldn't play some players, so it gave them an opportunity to get rid of them. But there has to be other willing participants in the transfer market to make it work. Now, I think we're getting to a point where there isn't enough willing participants in other countries to take players' offers at a value to make it work, which means over time, wages will have to fall, transfer fees will fall, in line with media revenues potentially falling. So there'll be a point where this is just, it maxes out, and then we just start to see things drop off again. We're not there yet, but I think we saw some... I don't think what happened in January with the lack of spend was down to that. That was down to everyone thought, oh shit, Evan, it's been docked 10 points.
This is real.
For 20 million. This is actually a thing that we have to be bothered about. So that's genuinely what's happened with that. I think clubs have thought, well, why spend now if I can just put it back until the end of the financial year in May or June and spend in the summer? But yeah, things aren't going to go up forever. Transfer fees, like you said, I think more clubs will start to look for value in the market. So there's a reason why United want to hire Dan Ashworth, because he headed up Brighton's recruitment and got them plucking talent from South America and Europe that no one had seen and got them performing at a high level, and then selling like some Moises Caicedo. Obviously Ashworth wasn't there then, but he was part of the team that brought Caicedo to Brighton, sold them for £115 million, you know. So that's how this works. So everyone wants value for money. I mean, Chelsea brought in half of Brighton's recruitment staff, I think. Liverpool were wanting to bring back Michael Edwards a few weeks ago, weren't they? So clubs want value for money. Every club does. They don't want to overspend. Man City invested in this a long time ago, where they'd have this network of trying to find players. So they have the CFG, City Football Group, multi-club thing. They got clubs in Brazil, everywhere, that they can house talent and bring talent through and identify talent to save money. I mean, because they aren't the biggest spenders in terms of transfer fees in the Premier League. So, because they spent all that money way before. So, yeah, I think the transfer market is going to come in for some change in the coming years, linked to media revenues maybe not being what they were. But that's not yet. That's to come. But the good times don't always last. I mean, it's feast or famine usually, isn't it?
So, if we have a little look at compare them to other clubs, because a loss of $9 million doesn't sound brilliant, but then when you compare it to other clubs in the Premier League, there's several clubs who bite your hand off for the loss of $9 million. In fact, not everyone has reported their finances for last year. That they're still coming through. Like I said, Liverpool's was last week. Villa, who I'm going to mention, sort of the last couple of days, so they're starting to come through now. But of the ones, it's over half of you who have said you have reported their finances for that year. There's only two so far who've actually recorded a profit. So it's Manchester City, who you mentioned before, Dave. Who had this bumpy year, won everything there was to win, huge commercial deals. It's hard to imagine a better year for any football club than the one sort of Manchester City has. So you'd imagine they recorded a profit, and they did. I think it was around £80 million. And then there's Brentford, who were much lower, I think about £8 or £9 million. They were a famously well-run club. Of course, you know, we're in the Premier League, established as a Premier League club now. They're the only two who've recorded a profit. So then you've got Liverpool sort of just under that, who I think FSG would regard that as more or less break even, because it's impossible to, you know, it's easier to win the pools than to sort of, you know, to make £0.0 million in a year. So, but then you look at some of the others. Arsenal actually recorded losses of £52 million compared to £45 million the year before. Their operating costs went up £89 million. So only £23 million of that was wages. So it's expensive in London, Dave. It's expensive to run a football club.
It's expensive in London. It's the price of them pints we got.
We were there for very sophisticated business meetings, Dave. I don't know what you were drinking. But yeah, down there, it's dear. But it's interesting they're reporting those losses there, even with that relatively low wage structure that they have. And yesterday, the Aston Villa ones blew me away. A losses of £120 million. Now, people who are listening to this might think, well, Everton have just been done for losing over £150 million over 3 years. Surely Aston Villa will get done. It's not as simple as that, is it? Because some of the losses you've allowed and some of them aren't. So the Premier League will be looking at that, and Aston Villa will be saying, well, some of this is for certain losses you are allowed and certain losses you aren't. But regardless of that, losing £120 million in a year isn't brilliant.
No. I mean, just to state, I mean, the FSG loss, as owners of Liverpool, the idea has always been to break even in a financial year. The value for FSG doesn't lie in the P&L at the end of the year. It lies in the value they create year on year and year on year. So that, you know, that £300 million investment's now worth £4.5 billion. So that's where the value is, rather than profit and loss every year, because no one's putting all that effort into a business which might make £2-3 million a year on a revenues of almost £600 million. It's crazy, absolutely crazy. There's no other business that runs that way.
Yeah,
it's bonkers. But in terms of Villa, that's the cost of trying to close the gap within the confines of profit and sustainability regulations. So they invested heavily in the team. They also invested I mean, so just to set out PSR, you're allowed £105 million worth of losses over 3 years, but you can have deduct some of your losses from if you've invested in infrastructure, which Aston Villa have. I think they had a £14 million capital commitment from the owners to build for infrastructure development. So that's immediately comes off your losses over the 3 year period. Now we're still including the averaged year of COVID 2019-20 and 2020-21 was rolled into 1 year. So those 2 years rolled into 1 year. We're still accounting for those years as that average year. Villa allowed to deduct the impact of COVID from that. So I think for Villa, that was about 50-odd million. So that comes off what they've lost. I think I did some maths last night. I think it was 185 million, something around that figure, over 3 years that Villa had lost. But in terms of deductions, they're probably chipped that back to around, 80-odd million, I think.
So they should be years. Okay.
I think they're fine. I don't think they haven't breached it because they sent their accounts off to be audited by the Premier League at the end of December, like every other club, to make sure they were PSR compliant. So I think they're fine. Villa are quite good at itemising where the money has gone. So women's football community, I think last year's community figures were 3 million. I've not seen the fully audited accounts yet, and that's where the devil's in the detail. But infrastructure development, in terms of academy and stuff, was about 20 million. So, there's plenty which chips off. I think I worked out it was about 80-odd million, I think, that probably is the figure there around about. Which means that they've probably got to be careful when it comes to the summer. But it's another reason why they didn't engage in the transfer window in January, because I'm quite close to the limit. But for them, it's a case of, do we try and spend to get close? Because the only reason to get better is to sign better players or appoint a better manager, and they've got a great manager. But now all they need to do is get better players, and they've done that kind of accretively over time. So they're at a point now where their players are extremely valuable. So Douglas Luiz, players like that. Who'd have thought John McGinn had turned out to be, the player he is. Ollie Watkins, players like that. So they've got loads of really, really valuable assets there. But they're also on the cusp now of the Champions League next year, which would be hugely impactful for them financially. And it's a bit of a Hail Mary to try and get there. Obviously, there'll have to be some pullback and they'll have to raise revenues in other areas. So they're trying to expand Villa Park to raise more from match day, more commercial revenue. They're changing from Castor to, are they going to Adidas again for a kit not supplier? Sure. I think they are. I think it's Adidas. And they'll try and leverage Champions League next year for new commercial deals for shirt sponsors and stuff. So kind of, I imagine this is their last sponsorship deal with a betting firm. Because if they're in the chat, they'll probably be able to call a bigger ticket than that. And that's all important. So I think they'll be absolutely fine. But this year is the last year we're looking at is a year of they invested in the squad considerably. They can't do that every single year, but if they haven't got the revenue streams to back that up, because they're not, qualifying for the Champions League is one thing, but, going further in the competition, they're in the real money is another. But by if they finish fourth this season, that'll be a significant rise in terms of their central payments. So they'll be okay. They'll have to be conscious of the PSR, unlike Liverpool, who just it's not really a consideration. Same for Tottenham, it's not a consideration. But I think the 120 million is like, how has this happened? How are they allowed to? Have they not been punished? But it's in real terms. I mean, it's all there. But it just means they've been allowed to deduct a few more things, maybe that Everton weren't.
So, I mean, just to finish up before we move on to the football summit, it does feel like Liverpool are doing pretty well. And like I say, a lot of supporters would like the boat pushed out a little bit more, would like us, to be spending more and to be, a little bit more aggressive in the transfer market. But if you look at it purely from a business point of view and you're looking at it slightly from an outside point of view, compared to a lot of football clubs, Liverpool seems well run, seems sustainable, and seems to be in a position to hopefully kick on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have this kind of weird fetishization of sustainable football clubs. I think it's largely because mine went bust because of the kind of account with a set of accounts which were made for horrific reading. So I think that clubs should be run sustainably. I think spend money in the transfer market if it's within the confines of the business model. Obviously, the issue I have is how do we find some level of equilibrium between all teams and stop. Yeah, otherwise, you know, stop getting to a stage where it's just the top six that can spend. That's the challenge for kind of the game moving forward. But in terms of a sustainable business, absolutely, it's a sustainable business. We've seen because there was a fallow year last year. And even through COVID, I mean, if you look at the impact of COVID on some clubs, just so it showed how close to the line they were. And then it was this drastic just drop off a cliff, whereas Liverpool managed to ride the storm better than most. And that's just down to running it like a business, but running like football clubs like a business isn't a popular trope, you know. So, I think in terms of the club's business strength, it's strong, very strong. But I do think they're better positioned because we're moving into a period of football which is uncertain. And I think we're going to start to see some elements of what was going up start to fall away a little bit, and being prepared for that is key. I do think that when media revenues start to fall, I think FSG will be cashing their chips in.
Do you?
When the media rights start to fall, that's when the value starts to fall, and that's when it's time to sell.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Moving on then to the Business Football Summit. As I said, the Financial Times organised in London. We went down, and there's a few things that sort of jumped out for me. One of the things that's quite interesting, you know, as a general theme throughout the day was, you mentioned before, it's very hard to make money out of football. The guys from the Financial Times who introduced it basically said, it's more or less impossible. And then at the start, I think it went as far to say that they don't see football as a profitable business. And then lots of people came on stage who begged to differ. Lots of people who, and listen, every business is like that. The statistics around new businesses, startups, you know, in this country, in any country, you know, you are more likely to fail than succeed. But people do it because they think they're going to be the ones to succeed. And I guess that's the case for football as well. There are people who think, yeah, it might be hard to make money in football, but I can do it, and here is how.
People came into football due to European football, due to the comparatively low cost of acquisition compared to North America. So we are... I mean, North America is a closed league in terms of its sporting leagues. So the cost of acquisition was high because it's more security. The media deals are 10 years. So everyone knows after 6, 7, 8 years, they know what they're going to earn. A promotion and relegation doesn't exist. And fans are less sticky customers. So they can pick up and move franchises in the US. Not everyone. I mean, it'd be very hard to kind of move...
The Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, the Dallas Cowboys and stick them in, you know, Wichita or somewhere like that. But for some of the franchises, they're less... So you only have to look at the NBA to see the different incarnations of some of those teams have gone through. You know, there's no more Seattle Sonics anymore, and, you know, they became the Oklahoma City Thunder, I think. So all these things. The cost of acquisition in Europe was low initially. So, I mean, the big six are expensive now. But it's still cheap to buy Brentford, even though they have media revenues bigger than any... I think it's bigger than... What they earn from their domestic media rights is bigger than what Real Madrid earn.
I think it was just below, wasn't it? But I think it was basically... They throw some stats up, don't they? And apart from Barcelona and Real Madrid, basically...
That was it, yeah.
Apart from Barcelona and Real Madrid, they earn more than every club in Spain. Which is crazy, really, because you said the size of clubs like Atletico Madrid and stuff like that, but the Brentford are earning more off TV rights than them.
But Brentford's value of the team is probably 3x its media revenues, which is 130 million. So that's because they're at threat of relegation and losing all that money every single year. Even though they have a great stadium, this, that, and the other, it's that they are not the big six. So that's kind of a walled garden, that big six. And that protects value. So the cost of acquisition for FSG was 300 million. They couldn't have acquired a North American sports franchise for that, which would have made money in 2010. But it's not, you know, they've now, that value of that investment has soared. And I think a lot of the success that FSG have had has been the catalyst for other money coming in. For some people, it's just maybe it's vanity, or maybe it's just they like, they've they're very rich people and they can afford to lose money or some money, and they like the idea of trying to win. I mean, succeed in kind of a tangible way in sport, you know, and try and impact communities. Some people are in it for that, but the biggest ones are in it for growing the value and eventually checking out. These big businesses, and FSG will make a huge return on their investment when they sell. But yeah, I think for many though, it's very hard to make money from football. It's hard to change the system which is in place. I mean, we saw the kind of the feedback the European Super League got, rightly so. But some people would come into a club and see, well, there's real estate opportunities to build around here, linked to the football club. But we've not really seen yet for a lot of these clubs how all that pans out and how they really are going to make money from it. So Liverpool's investment in the stadium will pay off in soon, I imagine, you know, because of the extra revenue. The club shop does far more business. You know, the stats in the recent accounts said the footfall was quite phenomenal, really. But a lot of the time for owners coming in, if they look for a new stadium, so AC Milan, so Redbird came in 18 months or so ago, 2 years. The main aim there is to build a new stadium just for AC Milan and turn it into kind of Italy's stadium, you know, and that becomes, it's a different strand to it altogether then. But still the view of Redbird, who are minority investors in FSG, is very much in line with what FSG do. So it's kind of manage costs, win, succeed by finding value, etc. But for them, the heavy investment will be in building a new stadium to support the revenue moving forward and bringing new streams. But yeah, there's different ways people want to make money from, which is wild, really, because like we said, I sat there and I was like, there's people who say you can't make money from football, then there's all these very smart, rich people who would argue otherwise.
Yeah.
And then, but they've all got they all have very different views about how to get there, which blew my mind. You know, there's no uniform approach to how people are trying to make money from football.
Yeah, and the biggest thing that summed up that for me was this kind of very wildly different opinion between, you know, regulation versus competition and what's fair and what's right and sustainability versus success. And, you know, John Textor was a really interesting guy because he came on and he's the a majority owner of Crystal Palace, or certainly the biggest shareholder of Crystal Palace. He owns different football clubs, you know, sort of around the world, and a really interesting guy. But he was wild on financial fair play. I've got a quote here saying financial fair play is a fraud, and he was talking about the fact that, you know, how am I supposed to compete with Manchester City and Erling Haaland if basically I've got an academy kid on the bench and they can bring on someone who costs 50 million. And I sort of wasn't expecting that from him at all, because he talked a lot about his love for football coming from academies and stuff like that, and how, yeah, you know, he was sort of so interested in that, that it was like, but I don't actually want to play them. You know what I mean? It was kind of a bit of a strange thing. But he was very flippant about the idea of, you know, football clubs going bust and how much this has sort of actually happened and things like that. In a way, I wasn't really expecting for someone who'd effectively bought Crystal Palace, but he did have some interesting things to say about, well, you know, other stuff and direction of travel. The idea of facial recognition to get into football stadiums was an interesting one, which he's doing different parts of the country. I imagine how well that'll go well got down amongst Liverpool fans. But I think but then you know other people like Gary Cardinal who came on and talked about the idea of, you know, football clubs being run in an almost kind of stupid way, really, and this race to spend as much as possible, this arms race, and sort of need to change. And you know, obviously people from UEFA were talking about the desire for sustainability. And I think this idea of, you know, there's some chairman who will want to work smarter, who will want to, you know, very much see it as investments and think, well, you know, get an extra value out of that extra spend. Whereas, you know, others are just seeing it as a case of anti-competitive, I think was a phrase used at some one point. You know, how are we, you know, if we're starting from a lower point, how are we meant to compete with these bigger clubs if you won't let us spend to catch up?
Yeah, so we use the, John Textor used the example of Evangelos Marinakis, who's Nottingham Forest owner.
That's right, yeah.
He's a shipping magnate worth billions. You know, he can afford to, if he wanted to, he could probably go out and afford to finance a deal for Kylian Mbappe to come to Nottingham Forest. but he can't. You know, so he was using the thing of, he was kind of speaking in the third person, wasn't he? And I'm so, oh, sorry, Mr. Marinakis, you know, we're worried about, you know, you've got lots of money, but we're worried about you, so we don't think you should spend that. And I got where he was coming from, but when you take the reins off everything, I mean, yeah.
It doesn't just affect Nottingham Forest.
No, and the comment about the clubs really go bankrupt. Yeah, they do. Lots. You know, maybe
not ones you cared about.
Maybe
do,
six,
yeah.
Seven, eight, nine might not. But that you know, might not be a huge number, but they are huge parts of people's lives, communities. And ultimately, all it does is fuel the whole thing to go to breaking point. There has to be a way to... It should be a case of forcing the top to spend less than encouraging the rest to spend more. That's my view on it. Anyway, there should be tighter controls around how we spend, which don't so much impact. It's hard to do a uniform approach across everyone because you can't. It's hard to implement something which says, right, Liverpool, you can't spend this, but Crystal Palace, you can spend that.
Mm.
But ultimately, you have to get to a point. It's the only way to achieve some kind of equilibrium. But who's got the appetite for that? Are the big clubs who are all voting members? Who's got the appetite for that? Out of the top 8-9 clubs who don't really want that to happen. It's a difficult one. I'm kind of torn on the way football should go with it, really. But I mean, it's an interesting idea, the fact of just abandoning financial fair play altogether, but I just think it would be potentially ruinous. And it opens a door to... it ultimately just makes the game completely unsustainable.
Yeah.
Clubs are allowed to spend to increase their revenue streams, but it's the transfer market which is ultimately what breaks football.
Yeah, and it's what happens when these people walk away, which is what I sort of end up thinking about, when you know, John Textor was talking about, you know, Forest and just being able to spend what you want. But if he gets bored and decides to go and do something else, yeah, then sort of, you know, what's left there. We've seen a little bit of that at Everton. I think it's not exactly the same sort of situation, but when a chairman decides, you know, he wants to walk away or someone else who may or may not be behind the scenes, it is suddenly sort of cut off. And then it's sort of what's left, really. It might seem all fun and games in the short term, but for football regulators, and that was, you know, we had someone there from the Conservative Party who's maybe going to be not in charge of finding the football regulator, but you know involved in sort of putting it together. And I think it has to be someone's job to care about the future of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got this regulator coming in, haven't we, which we're hoping is going to make some kind of difference. But to your point there, I mean, what happens? I mean, the Everton issue was exacerbated by geopolitical issues, so war in Ukraine, the loss of sponsorship through sanctions placed on Usmanov. A lot of Mashiri's money was tied up in Russian business and things like that, so it's hard for him to liquidate some of his assets and get all the money. So people are like, oh, that's a, you know, it's an exceptional event, that, though. You know, it's not going to happen all the time, but it did happen. And we live in a very, very bizarre world now whereby people have got money tied up everywhere. So before long, you're going to have crypto billionaires buying football clubs.
Yeah.
And guess what? That's a pretty volatile industry, you know. So, but there's all, you know, there's, you have to, ultimately, we're match-going fans. So it's, for the most part, I'd like to not care about who owns the football club.
Yeah.
I'd like it just to be, think that it washes its own face and it can achieve success when it goes out on a level playing field with everyone else. Now, that's, football's never been fair. You know, Chester have been to Wembley. You know, that's because they're a small team who's just not been very good, you know, for decades long. That's, there are just some clubs who, that's just the order of things. This isn't new, and there's always this race to change it. It might change over time. Life changes, you know. Manchester City weren't Manchester City 20 years, you know, they were their current guys 20 years ago. Mm. So things change, but if you look at the largest clubs in England, they remain the largest clubs in England for the last 30, 40 years. So yeah, I wish I had the answers to fix it. I don't, unfortunately, from listening to kind of Lucy Fraser, I wasn't too sure whether they had the answers either.
No,
but there's a lot of political kind of defensive manoeuvres going
on there.
There
was, yeah. It was like being at a Conservative Party conference at one point. And I never
which I would not be.
I never thought I'd be at one of them. Yeah, I never thought I'd find myself at one of them. But luckily she wasn't on for long. And some more interesting people came on after it. Some of the... I was pleased to hear acknowledged on several occasions that the days of thinking you can just bleed supporters dry are over. And I think that was mentioned quite a few times. And it should be said, we only went on the day. There was one day in person. There was some other stuff the day before, which was online, which was very sort of supporter-led, which is quite interesting. And I think, you know, the idea of... I think if anyone comes into football and thinks, oh, look at all these customers, I can just get a few extra quid out of all of them, you know, by bumping ticket prices up and this and that, and I'm going to be rich. I think those days are long gone, thankfully. And I think there is a acknowledgement that if you want to make more money out of football or even football fans, you need to be creative. But also, in many ways, just offer them something better. And I think there was a few examples that jumped out to me as a football fan where actually... people making more money and a better experience for football supporters sort of can go hand in hand. And they were very different examples. But a couple I wanted to mention was Michelle Kang, who I really liked. And she, this was a section on sort of can you make, you know, money out of football and investors. And some of them were minority investors and some of them, like Michelle Kang, have just bought football clubs. And she was very clear saying that she sees this as a financial investment. But there's some things that she's done to protect or grow her financial investments on the women's side that are going to be fantastic for the women's game. So she owns Olympic Lyon, who, for those who don't know, are one of the biggest women's clubs in the world, certainly one of the most successful sort of over the last sort of 10 or years or so. It's interesting that she's just bought the women's team. You couldn't do that for Liverpool at the moment, but she thinks that should be the way forward because it allows greater concentration on the growth of the team and also therefore the sport. But she's done... she's also bought London City Lionesses in the UK. She's got a team in Washington in America. But she talks about the growth of the women's game and things that are holding the women's game back. And one of them was there's a lot of injuries at the moment. And she talked about that, David. She said about one of the things that is thought that is causing more women's injuries is that football boots are designed for men and women are wearing them and they run differently. And so they're getting injured. And so she's invested in... a business that is researching and ultimately developing football boots for women, which is great because they should exist and that's going to help women playing the game from professional standards all the way down. But she's doing it because she's sick of her players getting injured. And so it's a good example of me of sort of something where you're like, well, this is a good thing. It's ultimately, it can be a good thing for women's football, for football sort of generally, and also help, you know, her sort of investments. Gary Cook came on and talked about sort of Birmingham City. And, you know, I mean, I very much take anything with a pinch of salt. Oh, these people just want to invest in Birmingham and stuff like that. And you're like, well, I don't think, you know, they woke up one day and went, do you know what I'm going to do? Drive to the second city in the UK and make it sort of fantastic. But these things do have a positive influence on certainly local fans sort of this football team. And the other one in a really basic way was the Spurs stadium. So there was a one of the panels was all about stadiums, and there was a lady whose name escapes me, apologise, but was involved in redeveloping the Spurs stadium, and she talked about the fact that one of the ways that they were hoping to pay for it, and one of the things that they wanted to do was obviously to for people to spend more once they were there, and that was one of the ways that it was going to wipe its face, so to say. She said they took people's spend from £2 to around 18, I think it was. Those numbers might not be quite exact, but it was quite the jump. People weren't spending any money in White Hart Lane, and now they are in this new Tottenham Stadium. And then he said, well, how did you do that? We said, well, we put better food on, better drinks, and we put entertainment on after the game to encourage people to hang around so they're not all rushing for the trains. And I thought, well, that's all good. So Spurs are making more money, but they're making more money by not saying, well, ticket prices are £10 more, you've got to pay it or else. They're making more money by offering better things to football fans, things that people want. And so this is a very long question, Dave, but what I'm saying is there was lots of different ways where I hear people talk about how they were going to make more money, where I was like, well, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it was Donna Marie Cullen. That was
so hot with the detail, Dave.
She's exec director at Spurs. So they said some interesting stuff. So I think she mentioned about they decided to remain in their location when they were building the stadium after the London riots, because they wanted to be kind of embedded in the community or whatever. So there was that question about how do you, okay, you've got all this great match day stuff on to get greater spend from fans, but how do you square that with your local community? Are you taking money away from the pubs and the bars and stuff? So they said they try and partner with local firms, don't they? So Beavertown were a local brewery. They're on a national scale now. They're sold to Heineken eventually. But so they ended up taking on the kind of craft, the brewing, the microbrewery that was that existed at Spurs Stadium. I mean, there's ways to make money, isn't there? I mean, the last resort for club owners is always to raise ticket prices. I think they try. You know, the ones who go for that move first really haven't got much foresight, because you should be trying everything you can to not raise ticket prices. So as part of Everton's offering at the new stadium, they're trying to turn it into a 365-day-a-year venue. Food, bars, everything. And down that in that kind of area of kind of North Liverpool, there's not an awful lot of competition in that locality for that kind of offering. So they've got a reason to keep people there. For Liverpool, it's difficult because they are, you know, they're in a residential area. Transport links are poor. There absolutely needs to be a kind of a rail link to Anfield or something, doesn't it? Sort of tram link at some stage. I know it's been kicked down the road.
Steve Rotherham hinted at it.
He did. I saw today. Exciting news planned.
That and the airport, yeah. I mean, I imagine.
That's because it's so hard to even just pop to Anfield to have a look at the experience. It's not an easy journey through the city, so that can be improved. I'm sure FSG would love that, but ultimately that's, you're getting into kind of local government and politics there, which is, it's something out of a football club's control, which is why building a new stadium usually comes with all these facets attached, transport links, etc. I mean, London benefited from the Elizabeth line, didn't it, being kind of energised, so it kind of addressed heavy kind of footfall and traffic, a lot of it football. There's ways and means to make money. So I think new stadiums, great. Spurs have got that jump on everyone, whereas Liverpool have got. I mean, the main stand was a significant thing because it changed the way that they operate in there. So hospitality was increased. But you can't just rely on hospitality. It's not just like selling a table anymore. You know, like it used to be back in the day. There has to be so much more to it. So the Anfield Road end. I mean, there's. I don't know if you've been in the new build since it's been up. I mean, it's more kind of a communal space. There's bars, everything, you know. It's more a kind of a meeting point before the game rather than just a selection of kiosks selling hot pies and crisps. You know, there's a selection of different things for fans. So the idea being, keep the spend in the stadium as opposed to risk losing people outside. But it's that toss-up between, are you harming your local community or taking away from business, or are you to line your own pockets, or are you doing it so you can keep ticket prices as low as they can be? So there is a right and wrong answer, but there's no easy answer, I think, to these things. I think that Liverpool would probably... I mean, the cost of everything goes up to run a stadium, so it's how quickly they can make that money up in other areas to avoid having to hike costs at the most kind of the coalface, which is match tickets.
Just to sort of round up, from a Liverpool point of view, it was quite interesting that there was a couple of people who've invested in FSG over the years. And so Alistair Seaman from Arctos Partners. I don't know hardly anything about Arctos Partners. And when I researched them, I found someone that you'd been over the last few years. And so I thought, well, I don't even know about them. Jerry Cardinal is obviously a bigger name and from Redbird. And Redbird invested in FSG rather than Liverpool, didn't they, sort of a few years ago. And now, as you said before, I've bought AC Milan. And he was a really interesting guy up there with Zlatan, a bit of star quality at the end of the day. Kept everyone there till 5 o'clock, not just the free bar afterwards.
Yeah, but everyone was absolutely fawning over Zlatan.
it was a full room for Zlatan. But from a Liverpool point of view, it was interesting because they're obviously, you know, part owners of an organisation that sort of owns their football club. So interesting to sort of hear their speak and their ideas of how, you know, investments work from their point of view.
Yeah, they're very different businesses, those two as well. So Arctos, who recently took a minority stake, but a significant minority in PSG. They're kind of they don't do ownership majority ownership stakes. They do minority ownership stakes. So they take small stakes in loads of North American teams. So Sacramento Kings, Golden State Warriors, bunch of others, indirectly through Boston Red Sox, FSGM, and Liverpool, etc., Pittsburgh Penguins. So they take minority stakes in the hope of just seeing growth when it comes to sell, you know, so they hold on to these stakes for a bit. So while some of the chat around them being business builders was said, I'm not sure that's really the case. I think they made a lot of sports investments 2020 onwards, hoping just to achieve some growth. Redbird's a bit different. Jerry Cardinale, that's his kind of where he's come from. Goldman Sachs, where he set up the Yes Network in New York. So I think he's kind of, that's his thing, business building. So, and him coming onto FSG is kind of aids them at a time. So since that deal happened, they acquired a stake in Spring Hill, the bronze company. And there'd be a lot more growth around how all this comes together and works. But I think the idea with AC Milan is to turn that into a powerhouse again, but through smarter spend. I mean, whether it works, time will tell, but the stadium will be core to that. But yeah, they're two businesses with very different kind of reasons for being and ways of investing. I think FSG are quite active investors. Redbird are quite active investors. They strategically, whereas Arctos aren't so much. So, but yeah, I thought, you know, Jerry in particular with the kind of the keynote speech he did with Zlatan, it was a really interesting take on kind of how that AC Milan project can work. I'm also around. I mean, he's, I haven't spoke to him in the past. He's team valuations or something which doesn't sit right with him, because we just pluck them out of thin air. We just do it of a multiple of revenue, really. Mm. So
I mean, he paid a fair whack for AC Milan.
Yeah.
1.2 billion, was it? It's a lot of money.
Yeah. So that was so the Elliott management was the people who had it first, but they acquired it because they had to. They didn't want to buy a football club. It was because they'd loaned money to the previous owners. I think it was Lee Yongfeng. And he couldn't pay anymore, so instead of risking losing their investment, they acquired the company at the club and ran it like a business, and it actually achieved some success, won a Scudetto for the first time in more than a decade, and then they sold the club for a premium, so they did actually quite well out of that. So but the stadium's a big opportunity for Redbird and AC Milan, and it's both Inter and AC are breaking off from each other. It's kind of they're ending that long association of sharing the San Siro, so it'll be interesting to see how impactful that is in the coming years. But they're already trying to leverage the AC Milan brand in the US because they have a relationship with the New York Yankees, and obviously Yankees is most globally recognised sports merchandising brand. I think, you know, people wear New York Yankees caps and don't even realise it's a New York Yankees, I think.
Yeah.
So there's that element of it. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it all pans out. But yeah, it was two people with interest in FSG with different, certainly different ways of investing. Yeah, so I was quite interested.
Anything else I've missed from the day? Some big names there, wasn't there?
Food was expensive.
Stop moaning on, you're such a northerner. Oh, we went to London, paid all this for a burger.
Took a while to get that pint as well. We were in the train station. Always miss my train. Yeah, no, there was a lot of interesting people there. It was so David Dean's always an interester, because David Dean's
asked a lot of questions. He was like a junior journalist. Like, he was so keen.
He was
sat on the front with his hand up.
Yeah, he was like,
chill out, David.
And it's like, you're one of the founding fathers of the Premier League. You're gonna be here. Christian Perzler was there.
Yeah,
we saw. Yeah,
yeah.
Juan Mata was there, because Juan Mata's trying to carve himself out a niche outside of football. I spoke to Javier Tebas as part of a round table we did there, obviously president of La Liga. Some interesting thoughts, largely about financial controls. I was particularly interested by about, because Spain operate a completely different level to what we do. All the teams know exactly what the money they have to spend on transfers and wages at the start of a season, and they cannot break that figure. So they know what they've got to spend. There's no real mental arithmetic done. That's all done before the season, so they know what they can spend. So, and he was kind of an advocate for that being introduced in the Premier League. He thought the Everton deduction was unfair, was his language, but I think he was keen for the Premier League to adopt something similar.
Yeah, real-time kind of analysis and transfer bans rather than kind of points deductions, yeah, which is quite an interesting thing.
There was another thread for that, wasn't there?
That was from a UEFA point of view,
yeah,
wasn't
the compelling
it?
The compelling element wasn't... you should never be... No, they weren't in favour of sanctioning football clubs because ultimately all you're doing is harming the revenue generated prospects of the club further.
And also affecting things mid-season as well, and that's what we've obviously seen with Everton.
Knocks on for everyone.
Yeah, you sort of suddenly dock someone, point to them, they get a few back and no one knows where they sort of stand, and obviously from a point of view of Champions League groups and things like that, you know, people sort of need to, but that was sort of quite interesting.
No, it was a good couple of days, couple of days in the big smoke, and I felt I learnt a lot.
Good.
We've just pick to the bones of it here.
Well, I learn a lot every time I speak to you, Dave. Thanks very much for coming in. I feel like having a word with Christian Pearsley, who once called himself...
Just read that from the script.
Well, Christian Pearsley, who was there, who once called himself the Fernando Torres of football finance, and nearly went up to him and said, excuse me, that's Dave Powell. I think you'll find. So there we are. But I decided not to.
I'm probably the Sean Dundee of football finance.
I decided to leave him well alone. Listen, hope you've enjoyed that. Do give us your feedback. Do let us know what you think. As I say, we've done similar sorts of shows before, but we are making it a little bit more structured now and a little bit more fish. So do let us know what you think or feedback. Appreciated. Any suggestions or what you want me to ask Dave in the future, I will be sure to give those a read. But thanks a lot for coming in, mate. Nice to see you.
Yeah, and you. Thanks for the invite. Loved it, as always. Sports Social Podcast Network.